This episode of Finding Fairways was pre-recorded and is a production of Blarney Stone Broadcasting. Good morning, golfers. Welcome to Finding Fairways here on Up North Sports Radio. It's brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne is in studio, and I'm on the phone with our co-host, Dan Pohl, from the Polecat down in Mount Pleasant. Dan, you and I were shooting the bull the other day, and it occurred to me that even though we've had you as a co-host on this show for a number of years, we really haven't talked that much about your professional career. I mean, we've talked about a little bit of your success at the majors, and we're coming up into a Ryder Cup year. But there was a few things that occurred to me that I think our listeners would really like to know, especially about your transition from a collegiate golfer to become a pro, and how difficult that was, what it took, and then ascending to, you know, the heights of the sport. So, we'd like to know some things about Dan Pohl.
Well, you know, I appreciate the opportunity to kind of lend some things out to your listeners. Jerry, you know me fairly well, and I'm not a guy that kind of toots my own horn or anything like that, so I'm a little, not skeptical, but I'm a little embarrassed about talking about that. But, you know, I go back to the opportunity that brought itself to me coming out of high school. And making a tough, tough choice. And I think that's what the first thing that a lot of people ask, you know, is okay, here you're a Mount Pleasant guy, you're, you know, kind of a three-sport type of a player, could have went on and probably played baseball at a fairly high level, but chose golf, and not only chose it, but took off to Arizona to do it. You know, having some opportunities outside of that with recruited from Houston and some other of the major colleges in the West and Southwest, but really chose Arizona based on one specific individual, and that was the golf coach that was moving into the position at Arizona, a gentleman by the name of John Gibson, who was a club professional out of Chicago, a really just a good player, and just who ended up becoming like a second father to me out at Arizona. So I chose it based upon never meeting the man, but talking to him on the phone. And at the time, he was 67 years old.
Wow.
Making a transition from club professional, Jerry, to a golf coach at a major college. You know, I just felt that it was the right thing to do. I love baseball. I love the, you know, the competition. I love the team aspect. But the draw for me specifically, and I think most people that take on this golf game will probably agree, is that, you know, whatever you put into it, you can get out of it. If you don't want to put a lot into it, then you're probably not going to reap any benefits. It's also probably the most frustrating and the most, you know, can be demoralizing, kind of ticked off you're ever going to be is, you know, if you're not playing some good golf when you think you should. And so when I went to Arizona, I basically was dropped off by my parents in Tucson, Arizona at age 18 and said, okay, here you go. You talk about the growth of an individual. I've got to say that, you know, the 4 years I spent at Arizona with no vehicle and a group of individuals that were, you know, really diverse in where they came from and really in a program that, was building at the time. Don Pooley had come out of Arizona the year before I came in, but other than that, not a lot of successful players had come out of the University of Arizona at the time. Everybody was at Arizona State, Brigham Young, Oklahoma State, New Mexico. A lot of really quality players were coming out of that. So it was a tough choice. When my parents dropped me off at the Motel 6 on 22nd Avenue in Tucson, Arizona, and said, well, we'll see you when we see you. And my mom and dad said they cried all the way home, and it took me a few days probably to recognize where in the heck I, you know, what I did and where in the heck I was.
For sure, you know, and talk about a fish out of water, like you said, a Mount Pleasant kid, you didn't go with anybody else. That happens a lot in golf and a lot of other sports. You team up with another guy from your school, especially if you're going far away, because if things go sideways, you're an awfully long ways away from your support system. So obviously you must have had a great relationship with that coach and some of your teammates.
Yeah, it really was a father-son type of mentality, but it was also he wasn't a giver of, you know, accolades. You had to work for what you did. I mean, I changed my grip my first year. I used to hit it a mile, but because I was a right hand underneath, I could really get moving it from right to left quickly at times. And so we worked on my grip, got my right hand a little bit more onto the top of the club and put me in better position more consistently, and probably was the toughest move I'd ever had to make, you know, because athletically I was very gifted. But, you know, trying to do new things and put your, you know, the speed and the technique into play was a difficult time for me, Jerry. And so I struggled with the mental aspect of not being able to really, you know, hit the shots I wanted to hit. But as I got more comfortable, I became more successful. And then, you know, starting to play against the quality of play that we were against the Arizona States of the world. And like I said, Brigham Young was strong then. I mean, Brigham Young on their team had five guys that all went on to the tour, Mike Reed and Nelford and, you know, Pat McGowan and all these guys. And then playing over on the West Coast in my freshman year, Stabler was a senior at USC.
Right.
And all these guys that you would eventually see move on and get on the tour, you know, that was kind of enlightening and said that, okay, if I can play against them, then I can probably, you know, be successful at this next level. But it was a struggle for a long time.
So we never talked about your college performances. What happened in your junior and senior year? Did you start to place high in the meets, and what about the NCAA tournament for golf in your junior and senior year?
Yeah, I started to get up there, and I don't know if I was second team All American my senior year. I've got a plaque somewhere, but I couldn't tell you where it is. I don't know. You know me and plaques. It's just
right.
Or memorabilia and stuff. But yeah, you know, I started to be successful on all styles of golf courses, which again was kind of my forte. Even though I was really, really long, I really felt like my iron play was my strength. And so there wasn't a style of golf course that I couldn't play very well. Played at Albuquerque South for one of the NCAAs my first year, and then went and played at Colgate another year in the NCAAs as an individual. Our team wasn't really good, but, you know, it was good enough where I had good competition, you know, on a daily basis. But, you know, the competition for me came from up north in the Tempe area at Arizona State. I got to know those guys really well. You know, we always talk about rivalries, and you talk about the dislike for your main rivalries. In golf, that just was not an issue.
Right.
I would drive up to Phoenix to be with the guys that I played competitively against, and we would have a lot of fun times. Went to Jay Giles at the Theater in the Round in Phoenix for one of my first concerts up there, and don't know how I got back to Tucson. It's about an hour and a half drive, but I'm not sure exactly how I got there. Yeah, just stuff like that. I mean, not only the competitiveness that you got, but the friendships that you made through college are still, you know, longstanding. And a lot of the players that I was fortunate to play with and against play still at a very high level. We all look back on friendships and stuff, and I wish I was more connected with those guys. You know, we've all went in a lot of different directions, and they do a golf tournament, you know, meet and greet type deal during one of the football games at Arizona, but it's usually right in the first part of October, and I just haven't flown back and been involved with it. But that's one of the things I think I need to put on my list of things to do is, you know, reconnect with those great people that kind of were a big part of your growing up stages in college.
Well, your teammates, they're always your teammates, no matter how infrequently you see them. You know, I still have a bunch of guys from my college basketball that will text when the team, you know, when the Bruins win a whole bunch of games, we'll text back and forth. But you still have your very close relationship with J.R. Roth.
Yeah, you know, J.R. was a funny little dude because he came in from Plymouth, you know, and I actually, the coach asked me, he says, what do you think about this kid out of, you know, Michigan? I said, well, I don't know a heck of a lot about him, because there was another guy out of Mount Pleasant, Greg Wagner, who was the same age, and Greg actually came in and tried to get on the team, and he was on the Mount Pleasant High School team with me, wasn't successful at the college level. But J.R. was just the same as he is now, just a plotter. Loved the game, passion for the game, didn't have all the tools, you know, didn't hit it long, didn't, you know, was not a guy that you would think would be the leader of most majors in Michigan golf history, I do believe. I think he's won six, isn't he? Is that the most that he's ever won in Michigan?
He and Scotty Hebert are tied.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, who would have thunk it, you know? But just one of those guys now that, you know, we reconnect with some of the things. But, you know, he was, I wouldn't call me a wild man, but I was very aggressive in college. And JR was kind of that guy that you kind of took under your wing and took him down a different road every once in a while. So we tell some good stories, but, you know, we got to be careful on who hears them.
Well,
but I think anybody, I hope your listeners really, you know, connect with all the stuff. I mean, we're human. We went through the same things. You know, we were college freshmen and sophomore and juniors. And, you know, it just happened to, you know, when I started to play at a pretty high level of the game and was, you know, won a tournament in college up in Phoenix that played against a strong field. You kind of felt like maybe, you know, at that point in time, you had, you know, at least an opportunity. You never knew back then, because when I first got on the tour or first started to look at the tour, you had two qualifiers per year and there were 25 spots in each qualifier. And so you'd play in the Goosey Tour or wherever you could get some rounds in and some competitiveness in. And then you'd go into, you know, this qualifying school that was for 25 spots. And you had to, I mean, that wasn't an easy thing. It might be 100 and, you know, 150 guys for 25 spots. And, you know, you had to play some golf. So it wasn't easy. In fact, I missed it the first time. I think I was at Pinehurst, went down to Pinehurst. I think they had it at 4 and 8 or something like that. And then finally got on the tour at Albuquerque South, which I had a long love, you know, connection with for a long time, because I still tell people it's one of the toughest golf courses I ever played, especially in the wind. But I hit, Jay Haas was on the green. It was during the NCAA, in 1976, I do believe. And, I bogeyed 1 and 2. And the third hole is 417 yards. And it's playing a little downwind. And I say the least, I was a little bit ticked off. And I got all over one. And he was putting for a birdie from about, I don't know, 3 feet. And the ball rolled and lipped out at 417 yards and rolled about a foot away and tapped into an eagle. So I went bogey, bogey, eagle. But that's my long drive story in Albuquerque, New Mexico on the third hole. So I... Yeah, Jay still laughs when we talk about that story, because he had to back off. Somebody said, "Here comes the ball."
Here come
my ball rolling up from 417. So,
see, that's the kind of stuff that we want to get into today. So I'm glad we opened up this can of worms. When we return here on Finding Fairways, we'll talk to Dan a little bit about those first years on the PGA Tour, what the purses were like, what it was like to live out of your car, and what it takes, the perseverance and the improved play and the mental conditioning to be and sustain a PGA Tour career. When we return on Finding Fairways, brought to us by carlsgolfland.com. It's time to check in with our friends at carlsgolfland.com. I've got Tim Coyle on the line. And Tim, last week we talked a little bit about the brand new 2022 Titleist T-Series, and you're already getting rave reviews.
Yeah, it's going really, really well. Our fitters, you know, all of which are close to scratch golfers, if not better, have been reviewing and testing it out since we've got our hands on it. They have nothing but positive things to say about it. You know, great improvements on what they came out with in the first iteration of the T-Series. And, you know, the feedback likewise from the customers that have been out to not just demo them at either of our locations, but for fittings and whatnot have been, everything's been looking really, really good with those numbers so far. So that's definitely something that should be on golfers' radars here in the next year if they're looking for some irons.
I can't even imagine them being that much better than the ones, the T200s I got last year. That would be scary because my game has improved so much. You know, one quick thing I wanted to say, Tim, I've never played Titleist equipment before. I've hit a lot of it in the past and never really loved it. So if you've been afraid of Titleist equipment before, now's the time to retry it.
Yeah, for sure. And from the T-Series last time, I haven't personally had the opportunity yet since we just got them in to to try them out, but last year they were on my radar too for an upgrade. But sure, their stuff is super playable, forgiving for the guy that needs it, and you know they have something for everybody, up to the guy that have tour caliber or really good players can fit their game too.
And if you're a TaylorMade guy, that new series is coming out this week, and so is Cleveland.
Yeah, TaylorMade. I can't tell anybody what specifically is coming, but there's a new iron and wedge coming. Available for pre-order this week, so be on the lookout for that. If you're not signed up for our emails now, you can do so on the website. We'll be sure to let you know about it this week as soon as we can. And what I can tell you about, there is a new Cleveland Launcher XL driver. There's three versions of it. It launches this week. They have a regular version, which is all, they're all super forgiving. They have a light version for the guy that maybe needs a little bit more club head speed and forgiveness, and a draw light version, which is for the guys like maybe myself that tends to slice the ball a little bit too much and needs a little extra club head speed. So yeah, they have an exciting line coming out for this year that I'm sure will just kill it.
Yeah, Cleveland drivers have always been known as the most forgiving on the market, and the only place to get those is at carlsgolfland.com. Thanks, Tim. Time to upgrade your game.
Now's the time. Let's do it. Thanks, Jerry.
On Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by our good friends at carlsgolfland.com. Jerry Coyne in studio with our co-host Dan Pohl down at the Polecat in Mount Pleasant. And Dan, relating those the stories and what happened when you went from Mount Pleasant to the University of Arizona, and then I guess they didn't have many satellite tours or a Corn Ferry tour then. It was either the tour or bust, huh?
Well, you had the J.C. Goosey Tour, which was a little mini tour down in Florida around the Orlando area that a lot of players went to. In fact, that's where I went. We got out of school in August, went down there and played in the winter. The first year I went down and played would have been the winter, basically, of 77, 78. They were down there. But some great times. Played some golf courses that hit shots that I'd never – dormant Bermuda where there wasn't any grass and Paul would sit down in little dirt areas and there was guys down there. These guys could hit shots off of this stuff that you would never, you couldn't put it in a lie where they couldn't kind of figure it out. Other guys would come in and they'd hit it over a green and it'd be down in between a patch of grass and on dirt and, you just chunk it or blade it over the green and make sixes in there. It was a great learning experience, I will tell you that. But, once you leave the college scene and you're out on your own, then it becomes, day to day, week to week. Most people look at the tour now and they see all these big purses, big winners, the kind of money that is crazy money. And trust me, I played for a lot more than what these other guys, when you look at Bobby Nichols and these guys that I know fairly well at 112. 15 times and have career earnings of a million something, you kind of go, wow, these guys win this much and by finishing third in an event.
Exactly.
But, when I first played, I go back to, making some cuts but not making any money. I mean, back then, I think the first cut I made, when originally started, it was the top 60 money winners were exempt.
Right.
Other than that, if you weren't there, you had to Monday qualify.
Oh,
but
God.
But if you Monday qualified and then made the cut, then you were automatically in the next week no matter what. But you can make the cut and finish 74th and not make any money. You could finish 68th. I think at Pensacola one year, I finished 68th or something like that, won $17 and something. it's hard to accumulate all-time money at $17 a shot. Not until I really, learned the ropes, so to speak, where to stay. Mark Lye and I and a guy by the name of Jim Mason, who was a great player out of Texas, we all three had vans and we used to travel from, site to site in vans.
Sure.
And the tough one was like, you just did that. I mean,
right.
I remember leaving Pebble Beach and having to go to Giraffe, in a van from Pebble to Miami. That's a long drive.
That's a drive.
To try to be prepared. But the first tournament I actually felt like I was there, which I came out. I finished third at the Western Open at Butler National
in
1979. Okay, you know how difficult a golf course that is.
Yeah, unbelievable golf course.
Playing, I've got the lead with three holes to play. And Bruce Devlin and Crenshaw are up there with me, and I get to the 16th, and I drive it right down the slot with a, I think I used a 3-wood or whatever. And I was so pumped up. I took a wedge, flew it over the green, made bogey, still got a one-shot lead. I get to, on 17, drive it right down the slot, another wedge, bam, 30 yards over the green. I was hitting shots that I was so pumped. I had no ability to control adrenaline at that stage.
Right.
It was the first time I'd really had a chance to win at that level. And then, so I'm back to tied, and I get up on 18, and it's about 310 to the corner, little dogleg right, big tree on the right, beautiful hole, sets in. I'd love to play it again. But I just bust a drive straight through the fairway into the hazard through the 315 mark that I'd have to chip out, make bogey, tie, and they went in a playoff. And so I end up in third place and won $17,400 for third place in 1979 at the Western Open. Thought I had come into my own.
Sure.
It doesn't sound like a lot right now.
No, but
it kind of put me in that position, Jerry, that I finally knew that I could play a really tough course, be in the position, and hopefully control my emotions and my adrenaline the next time I was involved with something.
You know, when you're starting out like that, Dan, and I'm sure it wasn't the same at all. Like caddies are such a big deal for the players nowadays. And of course, with all the dollars that you're talking about, they can win. Caddies can make a good living. I'm sure you were just getting kids or whatever, that guys that were just hanging out looking for a loop for a long time.
Well, the Western Amateur specifically still had the Evans Scholars that were your, that they assigned you a caddy.
That's a good day.
For the week. So so the fortunate thing was you knew that you probably didn't have to pay him much, even no matter how you played. And at the time, like you make a good point. The guys didn't live and die as much with one guy. They kind of, you had to see where things were going. I mean, there was, most of the guys were getting $400 to $500 a week and probably 4% of your whatever you won.
Right.
So it wasn't they weren't going to make a ton of money. You know, and then Fuzzy and Hubert Green and some of the guys came along and started having caddies that were consistently with them, that was driving their vehicles for them, and they were paying them a better wage. But, you know, the difference really, if people want to look back and see where, things started to change, the concept of the travel schedule of the tour, back in the day, you kind of ran things together so you could not have to travel. Tucson and Phoenix were back-to-back, along with the Hope. You played
right
stretch through there, and then you played Doral, Honda, Bay Hill, and so there was a step by step, and then things started to spread out a little bit, and the guys that could travel easier could get to places that had a little bit more stability in their life. It was a whole lot easier for them. I mean, again, I go back to the times when you may have Monday qualified when you weren't a top 60 money winner. You Monday qualify, you missed the cut. Now you're done on Friday. You got to go to the next site and try to Monday qualify at a golf course that you may not know very well. If you miss that, now you've got a whole another week to have to try to figure something out, try to recognize what it is you're doing wrong. There's a good chance that in between there, you're either going home or you're going to party somewhere with somebody and you're not, it became a very unconventional life because you didn't know what next week was going to bring. And then once you got to the top 60 and you could actually set up a schedule, then you really felt like, okay, now I can, I can have a legitimate schedule that I can look at and say, okay, I'm going to play here, here, and here. And then bang, in 1980, I almost won the Crosby, finished second, go in 81 and finished third at the PGA, and get into the Masters in 82 and all that. And all of a sudden my life became a little more, not simplified, but at least scheduling wise, it worked a lot easier. But, you made mention the other day when we talked a little bit about what we may even discuss on the show today. I'll tell you, listener, something that I've never told anybody. And this is the way it was back then for me and for a lot of golfers that were trying to make it. In 1982, going into the Masters, my manager, a guy by the name of John Lynch, who did Freddie Couples and Haas and some of them, we were all kind of together.
He called me up like on Monday or Tuesday of the Masters. And he said, "Polcat, I don't want to, you know, put any pressure on you, but you've got no money in the bank." This is 1982. And I haven't had that unsuccessful of a career there, you know, with a couple of, but I had, you know, got married in 81. I, you know, was buying houses, and it was, you know, life was starting to be revolving around golf as a business.
Right.
You know, and I literally knew going into the 1982 Masters that I didn't have or anything in the bank. And you not think that at that time, you know, people think about, okay, if you would have won the Masters. I was so pleased to put $39,000 in for second place at Augusta that week that you know, it took a lot of pressure off me on the financial side and, you know, some of the other things that came from that, obviously. And I've never told anybody that.
That is fascinating. I want to talk more about the differences on tour then to now, which obviously the finances are one of them, and just the whole mechanism has changed completely. So we'll continue our discussion with Dan Pohl here on Finding Fairways, brought to us by CarlsGolfLand.com. Welcome back to Finding Fairways here on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by CarlsGolfLand.com. Jerry Coyne in studio with our co-host Dan Pohl from the Polecat. And Dan, as you were talking about just a few minutes earlier, yeah, I can understand where you're starting to make a real living being a professional golfer, showing up on leaderboards, cashing some check. But life is expensive on top of that, and your agent tells you that it's time to play better golf because you don't got any money.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is, Jerry, and I can honestly say this and not even question it. The best thing to me in the game was not the playing of golf, but what I did was I joined in with Eddie Elias Enterprises, okay, which also had Fuzzy Zeller, John Mahaffey, Hubert Greene. They were all Max Y players.
Right.
I changed companies. I got to know Fuzzy at a level, you know, that a lot of players don't get to know him. And, I mean, fun stuff. And
sure.
Fun times. We went to the Philippine Open together with him and I and Mahaffey. I started to make money outside of the playing of the game. Now, you got to remember back then, you know, second place at the Masters is $39,000. Third place at the Western Open is, you know, $17,400.
Right.
You know, you make the cut, but you don't play that well, and you make $1,000, so you're losing money.
Right.
So you had to make the money outside. You had to make the money on, you know, trips to Japan or, you know, outings done with big-name players. I went down to Battle Creek with Gary Player and Fuzzy Zeller and Arnold and guys like that, and started to be, you know, part of, you know, Battle Creek Country Club with Ron LaParle, and did outings and became, you know, getting money outside of just the game. People don't understand, and I think you've made, you know, kind of led up into this, of what the financial ramifications are in the game today. You know, I can tell you, I had 75 top 10. Only won twice, but had a bunch of really high finishes.
Sure.
And my career earnings are like $3.5 million. One of the years in 82 when I won twice, I had 10 or 11 top 10s. I had, you know, another second at Vegas. I had, you know, a bunch of top 25s. Almost every week I was up there. And, you know, I finished fifth on the money list with $467,000. Now, if you were to calculate in today's world of those same tournaments, maybe a goal, it'd probably be a $7 or $8 million year.
Oh yeah.
But that's what you dealt with. That's what they are. And I'm not negative about that. It was what it was. But you needed to find things to do and things to, get you other financial opportunities. I was one of the first ones that signed a club deal with TaylorMade for, when they came out with the burner driver and that. I was with TaylorMade. And they gave me a nickel for every driver that was sold because
wow.
I was along the titter. I was using that deal. Well, it sounds like, wow, okay, that could be, but you got to sell a hell of a lot of drivers.
For a nickel, I guess. Yeah, you're right.
To make any money. But, you know, we would do pro-ams on Mondays for companies for $500, for $1,000, whatever we could make to you know, kind of supplement some of the financial things that we couldn't get, you know, from the plane. And then, like I said, it's not a negative. Actually, it made us stronger. I've got so many friends and so many business acquaintances that I met during all of these, you know, corporate outings and things that it did. And I still, to this day, believe being around Fuzzy, being around John Mahaffey, being around Hubert Green and guys like that that were open to all these type of things allowed me to open my personality up to be able to, you know, talk in front of a clinic and do a clinic. And,
right.
You know, I did a ton of stuff with Fuzz. I'll tell you a quick one down at, with Ron LaParle down at Battle Creek. We're doing this, I think it was a Gary Player, you know, kind of a deal for him, but we were all down. There was a bunch
some
of
kind of roast.
So we got a long drive, and I don't know if you've ever seen the one deal with my picture where I'm on the Michigan thing, and I'm in that beautiful salmon-colored pants with the white deal, and I'm at the Battle Creek Country Club. But anyway, everybody says, those are pink, aren't they? I said, no,
that's salmon, buddy.
Right, salmon. But we were standing on the first on the 10th tee box at Battle Creek Country Club, and we're having a kind of just a clinic stuff. And Fuzzy goes, okay, it's time to hit it long now. And he says, come on, pull. And this is when I could really hit it. And Fuzz hits one, and he goes, oh, man, there's no way he's going to catch that. It rolled up into the bunker or something, like, you know, it was 330-something to carry it on the green or whatever that was. And Fuzz rolls it into the front bunker. He says, you'll never catch that. My first drive flew into the middle of the green, you know, about, like I say, 335. And we laugh at this day to just some of the things that we put ourselves, you know, in and the fun we had doing those. And they don't do that stuff anymore, I don't believe. You know, there's just not that corporate connection that the players have. They would rather just get, you know, they make all their money, and then, you know, yeah, they're nice, they're friendly, they get out in front of people, but it's more on the social media side. Ours was person to person.
Yeah.
Ours was, Nabisco and Merrill Lynch and all these big companies, Bank of Chicago. I used to fly in and do stuff, you know, at Bobolink and places like that for companies. And, you know, to this day, I still think it's one of the, you know, premier or one of the best things that happened in my career was the ability to connect with all these different, company execs and company, you know, people that not always execs. Bob Murphy put on an event in Chicago in North Shore one year for Merrill Lynch. It was a father-son, father-daughter event. So the tour player brought in their child, and one of the executives from Merrill Lynch invited two of their largest clients.
Right.
And he played as a team with the kids and your parents. And it was the funnest event that I think I've ever played in.
Yeah, it sounds
fabulous.
And I actually
took my oldest daughter there. It was fantastic. I wish they did things like that.
You know, those opportunities do exist, but not, you know, the guys, like you said, the ones at the very top of the list, like Dustin Johnson, you know, the only time he's showing up is for tailor-made two or three events per year that he's got to do as part of his contract. The guys that are doing the now getting $35,000 and $45,000 for an outing are the guys, you know, in the 50s and the 70s and the 90s on the money list. But that's what they get paid. You come in and do a stag day at Pine Lake Country Club, and that guy makes $35,000 for, you know, a three-hour clinic and a couple of BS stories.
Oh, it's crazy. It's
yeah.
Crazy. We used to die for a $5,000 outing. I mean, if I could get that, I mean, that just, you know, that was a top 10 in our deal, you know. I mean,
right.
We used to go to places, like I said, for $500, $1,000, and think we were doing fine. I mean, that was good with us. But, yeah, the numbers are all skewed. But, you know, again, are they deserving of all these, you know, financial rewards? I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, the corporate world went crazy there for a while when Tiger got involved, which is great.
Yeah.
You know, Jack and Arnold, you know, basically drove that level, you know, leading in there. But, you know, I'm not bitter at all at where, you know, what they're getting. What I'd love to see is the tour back events that would bring guys like myself or bring guys like Gary Hallberg or, you know, that are fun, that, you know, are great with people and that want to be with, do events like that. There's a ton of retired players out there that would love to have five events, let's say per year, that somebody would pay us 10 grand to come in for. I don't care if it's a day or two or what.
Right.
That we could showcase or at least, connect with the older golfers, the business people, whatever it is, and really show what those years of learning and talking golf and experience were like. And it's actually all unfortunate that, a lot of guys have been kind of pushed to the back of the game that still have a lot to give to it. And I blame our tour for that.
Yep.
Because once you're off the tour, you're no longer an entity to them.
Yeah, you're out of sight, out of mind.
They have a pension for you.
Yep.
They have a pension program for you and stuff that you earn through making a lot of cuts and representing them and all that. But they don't do a dang thing to try to, enlighten or help players, would be a good addition to any, pro-am setting or corporate setting.
Yep. Well, as we round out this portion of Dan's career, of course, one of the shining moments was him making the Ryder Cup team. It's a Ryder Cup year. So when we return here on Finding Fairways, we'll talk about the Ryder Cup a little bit and the makeup or the possible makeup of this year's squad. That's all that and more here on Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by CarlsGolfPlan.com. Back here on Finding Fairways on Up North Sports Radio, brought to us by CarlsGolfPlan.com. Jerry Coyne in studio with the great Dan Pohl from the Pohl Cat. And as we kind of recap Dan's career, Dan, I know the 87 Ryder Cup is a bittersweet memory. When did the Ryder Cup first start coming onto your radar? I mean, were you a potential member in 85?
Well, yes, I was, but all of the, I don't know, the point system is the way it was over the, the two-year deal. Once 85 is out of the way, then I had some decent years, but I didn't have the consistency to draw the points. So once 85, was past September, when I started in 86 was probably my best year.
Right.
Overall with the consistency in the top tens and all that. But back then, I think they picked two players. And
right.
The top ten was always that key deal. And I think I remember it. I just remember the relief of knowing through that process of 87, being close, being fourth and sixth and right up there where you were moving forward. And then somebody would win and then they'd move in. And
right.
The PGA champion automatically got on the Ryder Cup. So when Larry Nelson won the 87 PGA, he was an automatically in there. But, it was so much fun. The Ryder Cup itself, the playing was difficult, but the camaraderie and the friendships and the strength of the team that we had was undeniable at the time. The difference was we were starting to run into a European squads that were really making moves with Ballesteros and Oldenthal and Langer and Lyle and Guzman and Faldo. I mean, at the time in 87, they had more world top 10 ranked teams or top 10 players than we did. And so the 87 Ryder Cup is a great memory, like you said, good and bad. But I think it's better overall because I think just from the standpoint of seeing the quality of play that Europe was bringing at the time, it started to bring that competitiveness, that enthusiasm on all sides. And even though we lost that 87 Ryder Cup, I think it was probably a positive thing for the game of golf overall.
I was there. I was at Muirfield in 87, and I had never heard of half of the guys. We couldn't even pronounce Olathabal's name then, Azalazabal and la-da-da. Never heard of Ian Woosnam before. I mean, Sandy Lyle, Seve, of course, Nick Faldo, his first Ryder Cup. I mean, there's like nine Hall of Famers on that European squad. I think they probably have more Hall of Famers than you guys had on the American side.
Well, I believe that to be true. And, I mean, again, it's not a negative thing to get beat by somebody like that. It just was so unexpected,
right.
Especially with Jack as the captain on a golf course that all of us felt comfortable with. I mean, I played with Hal Sutton two matches, and fact, you know, my most nervous thing I ever did in golf was on the first tee at the Ryder Cup. You know, if there's our listeners don't recognize it back then, you started off with an alternate shot or
right.
format, and the host team was the first ones to tee off. And, you know, you had the Star Spangled Banner and all the stuff going on. And then I was the lead guy on the American squad in the first match. I don't know if you remember that, but Hal Sutton and I played, and the Europeans were doing kind of a play with us, putting, you know, Bernhard Langer, who was one of the slowest players, you know, even back then and notorious through his career, and then putting a young man there in the name of Ken Brown, who was just as slow as Langer, you know, in the first match against Hal Sutton and I. And so now, alternate shot-wise, we decided that because Hal was one of the best iron players in the game then, and, you know, I was pretty good myself, but all the par threes at Muirfield are even-numbered holes.
Right.
And we felt that have Sutton hitting the at the par threes would give us a pretty good advantage. And we went out in the first match, so I'm hitting the first tee shot off of number one, and I just basically kind of crawled over to Hal, and I said, man, I don't have a clue where this is going to go, so don't
keep an eye on it.
You couldn't have fit a pin up my butt, I'm telling you that.
Yeah.
It was a tough time getting that tee in the ground, but we went around and played okay and beat Langer and Brown 2-1. And then we got paired against Faldo and losing them in the afternoon best ball match, and we played a solid match. They just got a break on the 11th green, hit a ball out to the right with Faldo in the creek, and it hit the tree and bounced in and went about 2 feet from the hole, and ended up, they beat us, I think, 2-1 in the afternoon. But great experiences. I still think that, you know, that's where I became probably more close to Payne Stewart.
Right.
I beat him in a playoff at Colonial. We were close there. But we sat and talked. I remember sitting on the ground signing, autographing things with Andy Bean and Cal Kubecki, and getting to sit around with Lanny and Tom Kite and Crenshaw and Larry Nelson and all these, and some of the great names of the game, and then to have Jack as your coach or the captain. Who could ask for anything better than that in their career?
No, like I said, it, I'm sure it's bittersweet. You guys would have loved to have won. It did change the Ryder Cup forever, giving the Europeans true legitimacy. And ever since then, I mean, we have a losing record against the Europeans, decidedly so. And I know we're going to do another show before we actually have the Ryder Cup in a month from now. But very quickly, Dan, I don't like the idea that we're playing on Whistling Straits. I think it negates the American advantage and gives the Europeans a very comfortable place to play.
You know, I could agree with you and I could disagree. I just don't know that any golf course in today's game gives advantages or disadvantages. I think they're evened out a little bit. The shot playing, they're used to, you know, maybe playing a little bit down, you know, running the ball a little bit more. But most of these top players, whether it's McIlroy and all these European players, play, you know, as much over here as the Americans do anymore. I don't know that you could put a plus and a minus on what golf course is an advantage, because I would go, if I was looking at an American side, I'd say go to the shortest, tightest golf course you could play and let Xander and these guys play their game and use their short game stuff and make McIlroy hit greens and make it tough around the greens so that they got to play a variety of shots. But who's to say that Whistling Straits is an advantage to the Americans. If the wind blows and you're not playing good, there's no advantage or disadvantage. I just think it's, unfortunately, you know, going out and hitting the shots.
Yeah.
I don't know that right now, you'd on paper, you'd have to say, you know, the Americans are stronger than ever. But, you know, that's why you go out and play. And, you know, all it's going to take is one or two matches to swing in a different way. You know that there's some European flavor that's going to come into the match. Terrell Hatton and those guys like that are going to be able to play any golf course.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. Guys are going to have to, and they know it. You're going to know that you're going to have to go in and play.
No doubt about it. We're going to dedicate an entire episode to the Ryder Cup in the next couple of weeks with Dan Pohl, but wanted to talk a little bit about your illustrious career and get, let the fans inside a little bit. So thanks a bunch, Dan, for doing it. And once again, the Pohl Cat, Dan's down there every day, so you call up or go online, make a tee time, and you can meet the man himself.
Well, you know, Jerry, you and I have become, I think you're one of the best hosts of radio stuff. I was actually listening to you, listening to one of the shows you were doing, talk up to Sault Ste. Marie the other day, and I was coming down, I was listening to, is it 94.5 or... Which one are you on?
94.5, 106.3, and 100.3. Yes, sir.
And I still think, you know, I've done a lot of this over the years, and you do a great job. And like I said, I'm not a big pusher of my own. I appreciate you taking me down some memory lanes, and hopefully the listeners enjoyed a little bit of my career and what I went through to get where I am today.
I think it's a great American story, a great Michigan story. So thanks, Dan, and we'll be with you in a couple of weeks to review the Ryder Cup. As we like to say here on Finding Fairways, find a fairway of your own, stick a peg in the ground, and pound it down the middle. We'll be back with you next week. It's time to check in with our good friends at Boyne Golf. Ken Griffin's on the line, and Ken, you and I are always talking about golf and the explosion and the popularity at a total all-time high.
It sure would be tough to think of another time right off the top of my head that it has been higher, you know, and it's great for the game. You know, we've got new golfers learning the game, so very busy time with the great staff at the Boyne Golf Academy, and, you know, whether that's for lessons or for club fitting, so you can enjoy each more round more when you're out there.
Yeah, that is so important. It's nice to see people get into the game, but they're going to stay with the game, love it more, and stay with it more as they get better, and then take those games out onto your great golf courses.
Yeah, and it's not just getting their game out on the course. We see, you know, a lot of families and couples coming out to play, especially in the evenings, more than we have in a long time. And now that also means more demand for tee times. You know, it's hard to believe that we're even busier than we were last summer, but that's the case. Fortunately, with 10 courses and high standards on all of them, we can probably find you a tee time.
Yeah, especially late in the day. I know we still got sun late into the evening. And you're right, a nice nine-hole round of golf on one of Boyne's courses with your wife or your wife and your kids just makes that family time so much more special.
Yeah, it does. As I said, as we always talk about, you can expect great conditions. And I'll say this, for the most part, you know, sometimes whenever you get a lot of golfers on the course, there's pace of play issues. And for the most part, golfers have been very respectful for everybody that's on the course. So we've had minimal pace of play issues, and, you know, we've got a good forecast coming up for next week, and the courses are in great shape.
So that's all the more emphasis to get to BoyneGolf.com, find out what courses are available when, and book your tee times. I agree with you. I've seen the courses busy, but I've never been pushed, and I've never seen the courses in better shape.
Thanks. I'll make sure to pass that off to the operations crew. They work really hard to provide that great golf experience.
They certainly do. That's what makes Boyne Golf everything that it is. Thanks, Ken. We'll see you out on the fairways.
I hope so, Jerry. Take care.